Whoever you are, we welcome you. Wherever you come from, we welcome you. Whomever you love, we welcome you. My name is Lori McGee, and it is my pleasure to serve as one of the worship leaders for today's service. I am joined by Cheryl Spoor and Nicole Zavadny, who are also leading the service with me, and by our guest musicians, Jesse Young and Tim Starton. And I also have a message from our church leaders about Melissa. With Reverend Melissa's unexpectedly early leave of absence, there was no opportunity to notify the congregation about the parameters of her leave. As you can imagine, Reverend Melissa is striving to balance the ongoing medical and nurturing needs of her newborn son, Owen, as well as caring for toddler Rylan, spouse Evan, and herself. Please respect her well-deserved and much-needed time off by refraining from sending her email or Facebook messages. Numerous leaders in the church are filling in during her absence. If you are uncertain about whom to contact regarding an inquiry or concern, please call or email our church administrator, Mary Beth Hannon, and she will direct you to the proper individual. If you find you are so moved to send cards or notes of love and care, you may send them directly to her home or to the church office.
At times, our own light goes out and is rekindled by a spark from another person. Each of us has cause to think with deep gratitude of those who have lighted the flame within us.
You may write down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Because I walk like I've got oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like moons and like suns, with the certainty of tides. Just like hopes springing high, still, I rise. Did you want to see me broken? Bowed head and lowered eyes? Shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries? Does my haughtiness offend you? Don't you like it awful hard? Because I laugh like I've got gold mines digging in my own backyard. You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your eyes. You may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it come as a surprise that I dance like I've got diamonds at the meeting of my thighs? Out of the huts of shame, I rise, up from a past that's rooted in pain. I rise. I'm a black ocean, leaping and wide, welling and swearing and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak that's wondrously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave, I am the dream and the hope of the slave. I rise. I rise. I rise.
As we enter into our time of shared silence, I offer you these words by Emily Dickinson. Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. And sweetest in the gale is heard, and sore must be the storm that could abash the little bird that kept so many warm. I've heard it in the chillest land and on the strangest sea, yet never in extremity it asked a crumb of me. Please join me now in the spirit of prayer or meditation, as is your practice. This is a Celtic Lorica prayer by Maureen Killeran. Spirit of all blessing, be with us in the ordinariness of our days. May hope's light guard us and keep cynicism from our hearts. May the energy of laughter build endurance for the dark times of our lives. May creativity's vision grant the possibility of seeing old relationships with new eyes. May the oil of healing keep us from anger's hardness or despair. May the mantle of humility give us courage to admit when we are wrong. May compassion's loom weave in us the discipline to forgive. May patience help us bear in mind that ours is not the only scale of time. May the flame of justice be a beacon for the choices we must make. May peace be ever in us and sustain our stressful days. Spirit of all blessing, be with us in the ordinariness of our days. Amen.
All lives have times of hopelessness. Mine came a few years back. My father's will had left my mentally ill older brother in charge of our inheritance. He emptied our savings, refused to pay bills or taxes, and maxed out multiple credit cards to cover it up. I could not stop him, but I was legally responsible for his debts. The tax collector informed me that if I did not pay a huge sum that I did not have, I would go to jail. I could find no way out, and so I gave up all hope. This despair destroyed my spiritual life. As a child, I was told that God loved me and would send miracles as needed. I so needed one, but where was it? Had I offended God? Would God never forgive me, not even after death? These fears broke me, and I found myself praying, "Oh God, please send me a sign so I can know what you want with me." Then I composed myself so I could watch Doctor Who on the television. And that is where I found a new way to hope. That may sound strange to you, so let me explain, beginning with a very brief description of the characters. The Doctor is the last of the Time Lords. He travels to Earth in a machine called the TARDIS. He seeks companions who will share his lonely travels. His current companion is Amy Pond. They met when they were both children, and their lives are linked. This is rough on her husband, Rory, because he and the Doctor do not get along. The Doctor himself is a combination of wise elder and hyperactive child. As that day's episode began, the Doctor was trying to find a place where Amy and Rory could mourn the loss of their newborn daughter. This is not bang, pow science fiction. This is science fiction which explores the human spirit. The Doctor chooses a world which has never known sorrow. Unfortunately, he is not a good navigator. He arrives at the right place, but at the worst time. The whole planet is under quarantine. When they learn about the plague, the Doctor and Rory take off in the TARDIS so fast, they forget all about Amy. The Doctor phones her, promising to pick her up in a few minutes. Instead, he arrives more than 25 years too late. Amy has spent her entire adult life in the forced solitude of quarantine. She has grown old without ever having been young. That was the first of a series of eerie coincidences. I had spent more than 25 years alone due to my disability. I, too, had grown old without ever having had the chance to be young. As Amy told her story, it paralleled mine in every way. It was as if this story had been written for me alone. It was almost as if this was my message from God, but that would be ridiculous, wouldn't it? Yet I found myself paying more attention to this story than usual. Amy started chewing out the Doctor, only she did not call him the Doctor. She called him the voice of God. And that was downright spooky. She said all the things that I had been thinking about God but was afraid to admit, even to myself. She castigated him for never keeping his promises, and I cheered her on. The Doctor told her he would just go back in time and stop all this from happening in the first place. Amy was so angry, she would not let him take away the meaning of her suffering. And now I was hooked, for I knew exactly how she felt. I don't know why bad things happen, but I need to believe that our lives have meaning. Our deepest sorrows and our greatest joys can't be as meaningless as a roll of the dice. And so I decided this was not a message from God. It would do till the real thing came along. Or maybe it was just that when the pupil is ready, the teacher comes along, even if that teacher is a television show. Rory decided the doctor should use his powers to save young Amy while keeping old Amy alive, but the doctor would not do that. He wanted only the young Amy as his companion. While they argued, I wondered, if this was my sign, what did it mean? It seemed to mean that God wanted rid of me, the same way that the doctor wanted rid of old Amy. That couldn't be right, could it? So I picked up a Bible and started reading it. It said the Bible is a book that always surprises, and it sure surprised me. In most stories, God does abandon those who most love him. Look at the way Cain loved God, but he had love only for Abel. Or the story of the prodigal son who wastes his inheritance but is welcomed by his father. Yet the child who served her father well was never given so much as a stringy goat to share with her friends. Or the story of Jesus praying in the garden, praying to a deity who would soon abandon him. Well, one of the Amys was chosen over the other, and that seemed to confirm it. God was done with me. But how could I survive alone in prison without a miracle to save me? I turned to the story of Abraham. I read it in the latest translation from the Jewish Bible. I love the humanity of the characters there. They are so much like the characters in Doctor Who. Abraham is called God's friend and companion. God comes to visit Abraham just out of loneliness. They spend good times together, laughing, having fun. But there is a price for Abraham. Just as those touched by the doctor suffer, so too do Abraham and his family. You probably know the story of God demanding Abraham's son, Isaac, as a sacrifice. How an angel stops this unthinkable act, telling him to use a calf for sacrifice instead. But have you read the rest of the story? Isaac abandons his father, and Abraham's wife dies in his arms. For many years, he can do nothing but grieve. But then he decides to take his hope into his own hands. He works hard, marries again, has many children, and dies content. All of this far from the God who has taken so much from him. Now I knew what to do. I would have to work to fix things, not depending on God or miracles. Like Abraham, I did not have to work alone. All of you helped me. Some of you brought food. Some of you sent me to government programs that kept the heat on in the winter or helped fix the house so I could sell it and start paying down the debts. Most of all, you have helped by welcoming me and caring about me. I've made so many friends here, friends who have become family, sisters and brothers, cousins and aunts. Some of you have taken me into your own families, and your children have become my grandchildren. You have no idea how much you are responsible for my happiness. Sometimes I sit on a bench outside after service, and as you all walk by chatting with me, I think, I could not be happier anywhere than right here, right now.
Many years ago, before anyone knew me as Ava's mom, and before I became a member of this church, I didn't like who I was. I was angry. I was desperate. Hurting in ways I felt I could. At the time, I was convinced that I was worthless, that I was what girl I felt I loved the most and kept continuing to fail. I felt like I was a failure not only to them, but to myself. I felt as though I had embodied the idea of failure beyond any proportionate measure, and I was destined to continue my existence on this world. I felt I remember how death, down to the details of my suicide note and my exact attire. I was strategic, symbolic, and in some weird way, still trying to be considerate of the people I felt I had failed. It wasn't them I was mad at, it was me. I was truly convinced that I was doing them a favor. I nearly completed my plan, but then something stopped me. What stopped me could be considered divine intervention by some. It was by me at the time. Just as I was completing my plan, I closed my eyes and saw my dead grandmother telling me that I wasn't ready and begging me to stop what I was doing. I remember her repeatedly telling me. Now, being the good granddaughter that I was, I did that as I was told. I called for help and was hospitalized for a few days because I'd already done some physical damage to my body. Now, that's only half my story. I don't remember the middle, and what I do remember are some frightening details. One of the not-so-frightening details, that night, I had woken bed, crying, go home. I was barely coherent that I was going to be sent to the psychiatric ward of Akron General. When I arrived at Akron General, I cried and begged again to go home. I wanted nothing more than to just go home. I remember apologizing until I cried myself to sleep that night. The next morning, I met with a doctor who insisted I see my psychiatrist and psychologist immediately. I was in shock. I wasn't expecting a second chance. Part of that fuzzy memory of arriving at Akron General includes a nurse. I vaguely remember being wheeled into a new room. That night, she saw me crying and apologizing over and over again, admitting my mistake and again begging to go home. While checking out of the hospital the next morning, that same nurse told me that she couldn't help but insist on a reevaluation of me because when she met me, all I was doing was crying and apologizing. I remember her telling me that I just kept stating over and over again that I knew I had made a mistake and she felt I deserved a second chance. So she insisted one of the doctors in the psychiatric ward evaluate me one more. That gave me hope. She gave me hope. It was in the compassion of a stranger, a woman whose face I can't remember and whose name I never got, that has brought me here today. The woman only knew me as a young mental patient crying intensely, doing everything I could to comply with the doctors and begging for forgiveness when I felt I didn't deserve it. I truly believe that if it wasn't for whatever was inside of me that connected me to my grandmother and the faith of a stranger, I wouldn't be here today. I'm not claiming that my life path since has been paved with diamonds, much as I wish it was. However, I know for sure that without that spark, that woman, and that memory, I wouldn't have the strength to use my second chance. Sometimes that's all we need.
My first wedding was a disaster. To be honest, my marriage was too, but that's a whole nother sermon. My ex-husband, Mike, and I met in late October of 1987. We had a whirlwind romance and fell in love very quickly. We were very young and very impatient to begin our adult lives. By February of the following year, we were engaged, and by April, we were pregnant. Nowadays, that doesn't seem like such a big deal, but 27 years ago, it was still pretty frowned upon to be pregnant before marriage. My family was upset for about a minute, but Mike's mother was a very conservative Italian Catholic who cared very much about what other people thought of her and her family and was of the opinion that no one was ever going to be good enough for her son. Most especially a very liberal, unchurched, follow your heart, the hell with the Joneses kind of girl from a broken home. She fought our relationship from the beginning, even going so far as to write to Mike's ex-girlfriend in their hometown of Pennsylvania, asking her to contact Mike to lure him away from me. When she found out we were going to have a baby together, the situation got really bad really fast. Despite the fact that he was 21 years old, she refused to let us see each other for a time. Mike was raised to not ever go against his mother, so keeping us apart was easier than you might think. She also emptied his savings account in her effort to prevent us from getting married. At one particularly low point, she called me at home and in a roundabout, not exactly saying the words kind of way, suggested I end the pregnancy. Of course, I refused. The baby was not an accident, and I was not about to give it up. When Mike learned of his mother's idea, he left home for good. My grandparents took us in, but with one condition, that we not share a bedroom until we were married. My grandfather could get his head around the pregnancy, but not the sleeping together part. We, of course, agreed, and my grandmother and I began to plan a wedding. We knew it had to be very soon, for obvious reasons, and it also had to be pretty low cost. We eventually found a church, her Catholic church was, of course, out of the question, and a place for a luncheon to follow the service. For the ceremony, I picked out a cocktail dress in ivory, not allowed to wear white, from Higbee's, it having been determined by my grandmother and his mother that white was obviously not an option. In fact, just about every detail was decided by someone else. I felt guilty about the pregnancy and didn't have much money of my own, so I just let others steamroll me about the whole thing. Additionally, I had a gut feeling that our families wouldn't get along well, so my focus was elsewhere. In the end, it was almost a relief not to have to worry about the details. We were married on June 11th, 1988, at the Church of God in Streetsboro. It was an interesting day. My first clue about the tone of the day came when the minister showed up in a silver suit. An iridescent, shiny, silver suit. Yes, it was the 80s, but still. And I think he was wearing more hairspray than I was. But I digress. The ceremony is very much a blur in my memory, but I distinctly remember walking down the aisle, seeing my family smiling and happy, and his crying and avoiding eye contact. The rest of the day went pretty much like that. The two families were like oil and water. No talking, no laughing, no mingling. I just wanted it to be over. A few days later, my grandmother told me that when she tried to introduce herself to Mike's grandmother, she got spit on. His family blamed mine for raising such a wild, immoral girl who seduced and trapped their angelic boy. For the 3 years we were married, this attitude about me never changed. Mike and I finally divorced in July of 1991. Even though my first wedding was such an awful day, I assumed my second would be the day I'd always dreamed of. Little did I know then that my second chance wouldn't come until 24 years later. When I came out in 1994, at the age of 25, I really thought my dream of having a beautiful, elegant wedding was over. Marriage equality wasn't even a topic of conversation then. It was a pipe dream. If it was mentioned at all, it was always accompanied by a, wouldn't it be great if, or if only we could. Of course, many couples had commitment ceremonies, but I couldn't justify to myself spending all that money for a wedding that didn't really count. And I knew all the arguments about how a wedding isn't about all the legal stuff, that it's really about the couple. But I also knew that even if I had a ceremony, I could never legally check the married box on a form. I could legally be banned from visiting my partner in the hospital. I would never be considered her next of kin. The list goes on. So we waited and waited and waited and waited. We followed the news of state after state setting laws banning marriage equality. Then the challenge to those laws began. We had a glimmer of hope. We saw that the tide was turning. Then suddenly, Massachusetts passed an equality law. And ever so very slowly, one state, then another, passed equality laws. Gays and lesbians across the country were beginning to get married for real. As you probably know, the last couple of years saw an avalanche of states allowing same-sex marriage. State after state, court after court, affirmed the right of freedom of marriage. So much joy, so much love, so much hope for so many. And then the shoe fell. In October of 2014, the 6th District Court of Appeals, of which Ohio is a part, upheld the discrimination laws. They were the first court in the country to do that. The case was then sent to the United States Supreme Court. We would have to wait some more. June 26, 2015, a day that won't soon be forgotten, especially for the members of this congregation. Even though it took longer, I'm glad that we were the holdout. It may surprise you to hear me say that, but I truly am glad because now marriage equality extends to everyone in the country. Every couple, regardless of sex or sexual orientation, can now be legally married, including me. After 18 years together, my partner, Joe, and I will be married on Halloween of this year in this, our beloved church community. I now get to plan my second and last wedding. I get to wear the gown. And if anyone's crying, it's from pure joy and love. I know that I'll cry through the whole thing. Hope is a wonderful thing. As you've heard today, hope sustains us when everything looks bleak and life just doesn't seem fair. Everyone has at least one story of hope to hold them that held them up during a dark time. What is yours? My call to you this morning is to share those stories, especially with the people in your lives who may need to hear them most. May it be so. Will the ushers please come forward? This is a community that offers hope to so many, in so many ways, ways that you don't even know, just by showing up, just by being present. I am grateful for that. To the proposition that beneath all our diversity, there lies a unity that binds us one to the other, to the earth and to the stars. We have gathered in witness. Let us take our witness out into the world. Go in peace.